Let me give you my personal welcome and tell you how glad I am to see you. How pleased I am to have the opportunity to work with the church here in these meetings. Tonight, I hope we can have what I'd like to call more a talk with each other, even though I'm aware you're not going to be talking back to me, rather than preaching a sermon. Because I believe that the thoughts I'll be presenting need your active listening. So I would really like to ask for your help. I'm going to try to talk a little more slowly and maybe even enunciate a little more clearly. And as I do, would you please take the responsibility of rolling these thoughts over in your mind and making an application to children as you know them, to situations as you understand them to be involved with children you know, your own children, of course, first of all, if you have them. But if not, you will either be a brother or a sister or an uncle or an aunt or a grandfather or something to children, so you'll still know how to do them. And I sincerely believe the thoughts that I present will be beneficial to grandparents, for example, because they will help to teach their own children how to deal with their children, and to others who are involved with families who have children, if they don't have them or you don't have them yourselves. Well, with that introduction, let's go ahead. There are, in my opinion, two especially important words to think about in the rearing of children. There are, of course, more than that, but these two seem to me to be outstanding in their importance. One of those words is training, which of course you see on the board there. And the other is teaching. Teaching has some synonyms, several synonyms in the Bible, such as, for example, instruction and admonition. Those are two common synonyms. But both these words and their synonyms are very biblical. That is, the ideas and the words themselves are used more than once, over and over, in the Bible, beginning almost from Genesis through to Revelation. The meaning of the two words do overlap somewhat, but they also portray different ideas. So what I'd like for us to do is to take both those words, training and teaching, and we'll center more on training tonight, but to take both words and look at illustrations and look at what they from the Bible and look at what they mean in those illustrations as well. For the first word, training, I'd like for us to read Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6. This is a famous passage in the Bible, as you'll know when I quote it, if you don't know already. It says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." Now, you know, and I do too, that many parents have struggled with the meaning of this passage when having worked very hard, as they see it, to bring up their children in the way the Lord wanted them to be, they then find that their children have gone astray. That is certainly a legitimate concern and a situation that we cannot take ourselves out of if we've found ourselves in that situation. But for now, please, let's focus on a different aspect of that verse, and that is to notice the fact that Solomon used the word train for what he wanted parents to do with the children he had in mind in that verse. It's clear that Solomon is talking about small children here. He's not talking about grown-up adult children or even what we might refer to as teenage children, because he's talking about training up, and the up there, I believe, refers to their growing up. So he's talking about working with small children. Solomon knew, I know he knew, because he used them. He knew the word teach, and he knew the word train, and he knew what they meant. And he chose the word train for this instance intentionally. Training can be done without words. And therefore, it's more important in the lives of small children. We speak, for example, of training for what we do with animals. And we don't talk to them, at least we don't expect the meaning of the words to get across. For example, a dog is trained to identify the odor of drugs or explosive. He's not told how to do it. He's not taught how to do it in the sense of this is the qualities of the odor and all that. He's trained, and he gets it, and he can do it very reliably, I'm told. Furthermore, so for that reason, training can and even should begin very early in the life of a child. When you cannot teach the abstract principles of the truth of God to a very small child because they simply do not understand the words. But there is another reason training is important also, and this is probably the most important one of all. Training reaches the emotions of children, and for that reason, it touches a different part of the personality. And as we will see, I hope you will see later on, that is a very important consideration. So Solomon talked about training small children. In contrast to training, however, the word teach implies the use of words. It always, so far as I know, implies the use of words. Speaking of God's commandments, Moses said in Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 7, "You shall teach them diligently to your children." Now, we had already would have gotten the picture that he's talking about talking with your children, discussing with them something. But listen to what he says in the latter part of the verse. "And shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by your way, when you lie down, and when you rise up." Now, there are important considerations in the last part. That is, when and where you talk about these things with your children. And I could sum that up by pretty much saying you talk about them whenever and wherever the opportunity presents itself. But the point I really want to make here is Moses is here talking about talking to your children, teaching them with words that they can understand and they can keep in their hearts and in their minds. The children Moses had in mind, by contrast to the one Solomon talked about earlier, were old enough to understand words and carry on a dialogue with their parents. Well, Solomon gives many examples of training, or rather teaching, young persons. If you read the first four or five chapters of Proverbs carefully, you will see very certainly that Solomon is addressing, I believe, his own sons and daughters. That was quite a congregation just in itself, you might remember, with all the wives he had. But he's probably addressing his own sons and daughters, but intending as well for that to be for other folks to teach their sons and daughters as well. And because it was included in the Holy Writ, I believe God intended that the same. He warns these young people that he's talking to, his sons and daughters, about things that they are going to encounter when they go out into the world. For example, drunkenness, theft, fornication, and companions, and on and on. You would know that he's not talking about a toddler here because they can't understand what he's saying. But besides that, they can't get into these things anyway. He's talking about young people when they get up to where they understand abstract thought, they understand principles, and can begin learning to apply those principles to themselves. He repeatedly says things like, "My son, hear the instruction of your father, and do not forsake the law of your mother." In other words, remember these things and apply them to yourselves when you go out there in the world that you're soon going to go in. Here's another example. "My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding. Then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. That's Proverbs chapter 2, verses about 1 through 5. You see again what Solomon is talking about. He's aiming here toward putting in these young people's minds not just specific commands. He's not aiming at building a conscience here. It's clear that he assumes they've already got one, but that conscience needs updating and filling with information that applies to where they walk in their daily lives. And he said, if you will do it, you will gain the knowledge of God. Solomon, as you can see in that book of Proverbs, tells young people that the wisdom to have a good life is there. He said, wisdom cries out from the streets. In other words, you can get it. It's there. All you've got to do is reach for it and find it. But you've got to be willing to take it. You've got to look for it. And then you will find it. Solomon clearly has talked with these sons and daughters before. And he wants them now to remember his words and keep them in mind when they face temptations out there where they're going. So to sum up these two thoughts that we have presented so far, training involves setting tasks for the child that will help them learn the attitudes and the skills. In other words, the feelings and the emotions that they need to have in order to do well in life. One old psychiatrist I know, he's not around now, and a lot of people didn't like him anyway because he was kind of abrupt in the things he said. And he said them sort of coarsely and almost rudely at times. But he described childhood as the place where you're taught what to feel and when to feel it. Well, that's not the complete description of what you learn in childhood by any means, but it is true. We don't come with a bag of emotions that just flood over us in any place or any time without our knowing it. We are taught what to feel, and we learn that in childhood, even though we may not be taught that intentionally, and the people who do provide the experiences that give us the lessons may not even know they're doing it. Teaching, on the other hand, involves explaining the reasons behind the task that we set for them and why it should be done that way. Or, as one man I know likes to say, it involves giving the person the principles so that they can apply them to themselves. Now, with that introduction, I'd like to go ahead and talk about training more particularly. And training, you may be surprised to learn, in important ways can and even does begin before birth. Yes, I said before birth. We've known for a long time that children in the womb, especially for the last 3 or 4 months, react to what happens in the outside world. So the environment that we provide for a child in the womb is important in teaching him his first lessons in life. They learn to recognize sounds, for example, movements, tastes even. If we get a chance, I'll tell you how they know they learn taste. Vibrations, and so forth. They show distinct preferences for some over the others of these. They show, for example, distinct preferences for soft sounds over loud sounds. For music, for example, over noise, and so on. They feel pain, contrary to what some writers used to argue, especially when they were defending abortion. And they show emotions. We know, for example, that they feel pain in very distinct ways. But some people now argue that children in the womb experience no emotions. But I choose to take the ultimate authority on that. And John the Baptist's mother, when she was just about 6 months alone with John the Baptist, was visited by Mary, the mother-to-be of Jesus. And Elizabeth told Mary at their greetings, "Indeed, as soon as the voice of your greeting sounded in my ears, the babe in my womb leapt for joy." Since Elizabeth was speaking an inspired word here, which was quoted by apostles and prophets as such, I don't have any doubt that what she was talking about. And we know certainly from the time of their birth, the day of their birth, and the birth act itself, or experience itself, would not teach them how to do this. They experienced a primitive kind of emotion that we call elation, when their sense of well-being is better. For example, when a child is hungry and feels pain, his sense of well-being is depressed, and he cries because he feels the difference in how safe he feels when he's hungry and his stomach is cramping and gnawing than when he's fed and it's up. You can see that difference in emotion within a few minutes when a child is crying out of hunger and then is fed and he gurgles and goos and goes on. Well, that didn't happen just the day he was born. So John the Baptist certainly felt the emotion of his mother, and he was elated also because of it. Perhaps you'd like to know a little more about how we know the reactions of unborn infants. And in addition to what we know from the ultimate authority of the Bible, there is some very good research on unborn infants now. We know absolutely that they learn, that they feel pain, and this was taught to us by an unlikely source, and that was by tiny cameras attached to the end of instruments when doctors were doing abortions. And those tiny cameras recorded the same screaming motions, the same writhing motions that adults have when they feel pain. We learn their preferences for certain sounds, for example, by giving them what's called a non-nutritive nipple. That just means a nipple that has no milk attached to it, but in fact is rigged so that they can control the sounds that go in their ear through either headphones or a speaker close by. And we know from the fact that because they can control the sounds by fast sucking or slow sucking, hard sucking or soft sucking, we know, for example, that they prefer soft sounds over loud sounds. We know, for example, that they prefer songs that they're familiar with because they've been played to them while they were in the room over songs that are brand new to them, and they don't like them. Incidentally, they don't like the harsh sounds of loud music. I don't either. And they like the soft sounds of soothing music better. They prefer their mother's voice in the first 2 or 3 weeks of life, muffled as they heard it in the womb. But because they're hearing their mother's voice straight after 3 weeks or so, they prefer it straight. Now, all of these things simply tell us that a child is being trained by his environment very early in life. We don't know the specific day. It probably varies with different children. But we know that in the last months of life, that training gets going very well. MRI photos show now regularly what doctors doing C-sections learned a long time ago, and that is that children learn to soothe themselves often before birth. One of the main ways they do this is by learning to suck their thumbs. So when they feel upset, even in the womb, they sense the soothing nature of sucking their thumbs. This may sound like a very unimportant thing, but it's not an unimportant thing. It's a building block to things that, in fact, are quite important. The ability to comfort and soothe themselves to sleep makes the difference between what parents, in my group at least, used to call good babies as opposed to irritable babies, or calm infants as opposed to anxious ones. No parent is going to disparage a child's ability to put themselves to sleep, to entertain themselves quietly for a while, and so forth. But that ability to soothe themselves is the beginning of that ability. And it's the beginning of something even more important, which we'll talk about later. Now, I know that's a short course in neonatal research of one kind or another, which is a substantial and very growing field, but it is quite important, I believe, to know these things. You might ask, well, if it's important, what practical thing do they mean to us? They are a part of some of the most important things that occur in a child's development, such as the attachment to the mother's voice. That attachment is step one, or the first foundation stone in a child's development of a conscience. It includes a bonding with the father, hopefully soon after he bonds with the mother, or even at about the same time. And if the father is around enough for him to bond with it, he will bond with the mother's voice, because fortunately for the child and the mother, they can't be separated until birth. So he's going to bond with the mother's voice, if she allows him, even before birth. When I say allow, some mothers have been known, of course, to keep themselves so zonked out in one way or another that they don't talk much, and so the child doesn't have much of an opportunity. Some fathers are not around enough and don't hear the father's voice in such a way as to allow them to bond. Or sometimes the mother and the father may harshly talk to each other so much that the child doesn't want to bond with it, and in fact is frightened from it. So yes, it is a matter of giving the child a chance to bond with it, as well as in the case of the father, for example, him being there so that it can be done. To explain how this bonding with the mother and then the father's voice, and after his birth, the mother born, the mother and the father's person, we need to talk about how a conscience is built. I know this is an important thing, and you do too, but we have seen it generally as such a mystery about how a conscience is developed that we really don't know even how to think about it. And quite honestly, there's very little useful talk in the professional literature about how a child's conscience is made. There's plenty of recognition about how important it is, but not much about how it actually comes about. But I believe the Bible really does furnish us all the things we need. And I believe it does on this as well. I'm going to only use one passage to show you what I'm talking about on this, because it's the clearest one I know of, but the idea is embedded in other passages as well. It's a short passage, at least the way I'll use it here is a short passage, 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 9. Paul is here talking about the deacons, and he said that they must be able, quote, to hold the mystery of the faith in a pure conscience. Even in the English translation, we can see the apostle's analogy of a container and its contents. Now, that whole idea of a container and its contents is very familiar to us from another source. But this is a source that is, I believe, equally as important. I'm told that the Greek language makes this even clearer. But the picture of a container and its contents is undeniable. One writer describes this, one old commentator, they knew this, for example, in the 1800s at least, describes the conscience as the golden bowl and the precious liquid as the contents of that golden bowl or the container. Still another one describes the container part of the conscience as a clear, clean glass, and then the liquid, that is the information that is in it, as the liquid contained in the clear glass. The precious liquid of faith cannot be held if one doesn't have a container for it. If the container is not good, whatever is put in there will just drain away. Now, most of you are too young to remember this, and I realize that this discussion for the next few seconds is going to date me as being from the Dark Ages, but still, it's a good discussion. We used to hold to draw our water out of a well and put it into what was called a water bucket in the house for people to pass by and get a drink and for the mothers to cook with. But sometimes those old galvanized zinc water buckets would develop a hole in them, and you learn various ways of patching them, because the matter was very clear that if your bucket had a hole in it, the water would simply, slowly but surely, sometimes rapidly, when the hole was big enough, drain out. Well, that's just the basic law of containers and the contained, isn't it? Now, think about this. We've often wondered why people who grew up in a good church, who seemed to understand and believe the things that were taught in the church, and sometimes they would leave there, go away to university, or sometimes even go away on a vacation and fall in with people and do things we never even dreamed in our wildest imaginations they could do. And we said, how in the world were they able to do that? Well, obviously, for some reason, that container had not been built right, and so it could not hold the precious liquid of faith that was put in it. Now, there might be other explanations of that, at least one other, which we'll touch on briefly, but that's what people call in the psychiatric world a sociopath, somebody who didn't get a good container for his conscience. So he may have been taught good things somewhere down the line, but they just drained out and they didn't stay in there. So that means this, that in the development of a human being, we must first build a container, and that is built, I believe, through early training. Later on, when he is able to understand facts and principles, or as the educators say, think abstractly, we fill that container with God's truths, the principles by which one should take and measure himself. And then that person has a conscience, a good conscience, that with appropriate updating from the scriptures as he grows spiritually, will be a good guide for him through life. Now that's the kind of conscience that every parent wants for his child. So let's try now to define how this container part of the conscience is built a little more clearly. It begins, I believe, with a deep, as we've already said briefly, deep emotionally based attachment to the mother. Later, of course, the attachment is extended, maybe not even much later, but to the father. And then gradually to others around the child, because he sees the mother and the father value and respect these people, and then ultimately it's extended to God. I believe this attachment that we're talking about, that forms the first building blocks of the conscience, are made up of two ingredients, love and respect. The love comes first, and that is born out of the security that is provided first by the mother and then by the father as well. A child intuitively recognizes his dependence on his parents, first especially the mother. You see that acted out or demonstrated when a mother disappears and a child looks and finds her not there and cries. He knows he's attached to the mother. He knows she's important to him. He can't express it in words, but he feels it. It is an emotion. The infant senses his need for the mother. He knows intuitively that she's the one who supplies his needs. In the womb, he was never hungry. Loud noises were muted, sharp edges were smoothed out, and in every other way that we know, he had a good environment. He associates the security of that environment with a voice that he hears and the sound of that heart that beats in his ears, which is probably the very first sound he ever recognized. And when that person is there, that voice, that warmth, that love, he feels secure. When a child is born, the idyllic condition changes somewhat, but in a home where the care is good, the change is not so great as to destroy the security. He still hears the magical voice, and it still has the power to calm and soothe him. He lays on his mother's breast, and he feels the warmth again, and he again hears that magical sound that beats in his ear. Her body still supplies the food that he needs. And fortunately for the last few months in the womb and the first several months outside the womb, there is no need for anything except love, peace, peace and security to pass between the mother and the child. This is the first part, that sense of security and sense of love of the container part of the conscience. I believe David understood this quite well. It's amazing how much you find in the Bible when you start looking on specific subjects, and especially if you read the whole Bible through, because many of the truths of God were written down in the Old Testament as well as the New. David understood it. He said this, listen, I want you to just kind of let this sink in your ears and please try to feel what David is talking about. Oh Lord, my heart is not lifted up. My eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. Solomon needed to learn that lesson, didn't he? He didn't get that across to his son. But let's go again. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me. I have calmed and quieted my soul like a child quieted at its mother's breast. Like a child that is quieted is my soul. Psalms 131, verse 2. I believe David is saying very clearly that I have found the security in God that I used to find at my mother's breast. That was a part of David's being. Now the second part of the maternal relationship and paternal relationship, I believe, is made up of respect. Love and respect. And respect is born out of fear of loss. Let's take just a small example here. A 12-month-old child who can now crawl, he's mobile, not very fast, but he can get around. A 12-month-old child, let's say, crawls to an electrical cord. And for the first time, he takes it in his mouth. Now, he's got two sharp teeth down below and two above. And the mother instantly recognizes that situation and shouts an anxious, "No!" Now, the difference in her voice arrests him, and he looks to her to see what is wrong. He cannot explain in words what is wrong, but he feels the fact that he's now seeing a new side of his mother. Until now, he's not been able to do anything that needed correction, so she didn't need to use that voice. But now he is. He's mobile. He can crawl away from her, and he's dexterous enough that he can do things that she will see as dangerous. And she will from now on see numerous things he does. And she will have to use that same tone of voice with him. Eventually, he will test her. And he will test his father's will. And hopefully, they will respond appropriately. In this process and over the years, he will discover what Paul said we adults should discover about our Heavenly Father. Behold, therefore, the goodness and the severity of God. Romans chapter 11 and verse 22. The goodness produces that love, and the firmness produces that respect that we have been talking about. Now, if all goes well with this child, by the time he is 8 or 9, he will come to the place where he will understand some of life's most important lessons. And they will not just be an intellectual understanding. They'll be a deep-seated, emotionally based conviction that is there as a part of his personality. We can speak of these truths that he will learn and that will become a part of his personality in a number of different ways, but I'd like to tell you the ones I formulated for myself when I was preparing this talk, because I believe these are the way the child understands them. I am important to other people, and they are important to me. What I do matters to other people. Remember when Mom shouted? No. He saw that what he was doing mattered to Mom. What I do matters to other people, and what they do matters to me. I need other people, and they need me as well. The short version of this is that he comes to trust the important people in his life and to respect their authority. He knows that they love him, and he knows that he needs and loves them. These deep, emotionally based convictions are the basis for the conscience. They are the golden bowl or the container. And then later, when the great truths of God's word are built on this gradually and over the years, that's the golden liquid that's poured in it, or in another writer's words, the precious liquid that's poured in it. And together, they become that good conscience that every parent, every wise parent, wants to instill in his child. Now, I know I've been going long on this, going longer than I usually do, in fact. That's probably the result of the fact that I tried to speak more slowly with this. But I want to close this talk by talking about self-discipline. And I think you can make the jump easily from what we've been talking about to self-discipline. And that is, self-discipline is related to the conscience in these ways. The conscience is that inner part of us that holds our beliefs and convictions and hurts us when we violate them. But self-discipline is the ability to stand against the influence of others and the influence of our own urgings, our desires, our selfish ambition, for example, our lust, etc., etc. It's the ability to stand against the influence of others and the desires that come from inside us and to make us do what we know we ought to do. Or do what our conscience tells us is right. So self-discipline is needed to carry out the wishes of our consciousness, our conscience, and our conscience helps to motivate us to self-discipline. To put the matter in briefer terms, self-discipline is the ability to say no to ourselves about the things we should not do, and the ability to make ourselves do what we know we ought to do. Now, when you have a conscience that tells you the right thing, and then you have the self-discipline to live by your conscience, you got a person who will do right, regardless almost of the circumstances. So I want to talk in the last few minutes of this talk about How do you train self-discipline in a child? Everyone agrees we need it. It's what we call most of the time maturity. If we see somebody who follows his desires, for example, he doesn't want to go to work, so he doesn't go to work, not because he's sick, but just because he doesn't, quote, feel like going to work that day, we say he's immature. And that's a good enough way of explaining it. But what it means is he knows he ought to go to work because he needs the money, but he doesn't have the power, the self-discipline, to make himself do what he needs to do. And so we say he's immature. Another way is to say he lacks self-discipline. So how do you train self-discipline in a child? How do you begin training self-discipline in a child? No child comes into the world wanting to do some of the things he has to learn to do. And some of the simplest ones that we train in almost every child provide a good model for how to train self-discipline into a child. Practically no child comes into the world wanting to brush his teeth. It really sounds pretty unnatural when you think about it, doesn't it? That you take some soap and put it on the end of a stiff brush and put that in your mouth and rub it around. But now I'm talking like a child, aren't I? Because every one of you don't like to go more than a few hours, at least not more than the working day, without brushing your teeth. But how do mothers and fathers train a child to brush their teeth? That's self-discipline. It's kind of the epitome of self-discipline. Well, a mother does it like this, very calmly, very routinely. She just takes the child by the hand, leads him one day to the lavatory, shows him the toothbrush, allows him to watch her, perhaps, as she puts it on it and brushes her teeth, smiles, maybe even a little more than she ordinarily smiles when she brushes her teeth, to give him the idea that it can become pleasant. And then she allows him to watch as she puts some on his toothbrush, and she follows the few steps that she did with herself of putting it in there and brushing it around. This is so simple, I don't need to go into detail about it. But you know that he didn't like it the first time. He just assumed she quit right then and there. But she doesn't. She keeps doing it. After a few weeks, you know, she begins to let him do it a little bit, but she still checks and finishes the job. And, you know, after a few more weeks, he's beginning to do it himself. After a few months, she's letting him do it, but she still reminds him. And she still checks to see if he's doing it. And then after a few years, he's doing it generally by himself, but even then, she'll check every now and then just to see that he's doing it and remind him of it. And then eventually, he gets to the point that he doesn't like the feel of dirty teeth and food between his teeth. And so he does it all on his own. And it wasn't hard at all, was it? Well, honestly, you can train self-discipline in the exact same way in nearly everything you do. Whether it's teaching a child to get up on his own by the alarm clock that he sets himself, or any other thing. And that's the way you get that ability to stand against others and your own base desires and live the kind of life you want to live. I want to close by just reminding you, I'm not even going to read all these verses, but just reminding you of how often the Bible talks about self-discipline. For example, in Titus chapter 1, verse 8, it's one of the qualifications of an elder. We wouldn't think about putting a man in as an elder if he wasn't self-disciplined enough to do what he knows he ought to do, would we? It's one of the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians chapter 5, verse 23. In other words, the Spirit will help you develop this characteristic if you let him know you want to. It's the second of the seven Christian graces in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 6. And it's one of the three things that Paul talked to Felix about in Acts chapter 24, verse 25, when he got a chance to preach only one sermon to this powerful man. Well, I hope these thoughts have been beneficial to you. I have no illusion that this is all you ever wanted to know about training young children, but hopefully it's given you some ideas that will make a contribution to it, and hopefully you can guide yourself or talk with others and continue adding to your thoughts along that line. It may be that there is someone who is in the audience tonight who's not been obedient to the gospel. And we don't want to close any church service without extending the invitation. Should there be someone who's brought himself or studied with others and come to the place that he wants to obey the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. If you believe that Jesus truly is the Son of God, and I believe that from the very depths of my being, if you're ready to turn away from whatever sins you have in your life, whatever sins you know about, that's repentance. And then if you're ready to confess the Lord before men, you inherit the promise that he'll confess you before his Father and the holy angels. And then you're ready to be buried with the Lord in baptism and rise to walk a new life in Christ Jesus. What a wonderful thing. Your name is then written in heaven. That means you're a citizen of God's kingdom, the eternal kingdom. The United States will one day pass away. All earthly kingdoms do. Britain, Germany, France, they sound like stable governments now, but they'll one day pass away. But God's kingdom never passes away. And you can be a member of it. If you're a Christian and there's something in your life that you need to have God's forgiveness for, a sin you've committed, or a habit you want help breaking, or whatever, if you need the prayers of the church, come while we stand and sing.